Where There's a Will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.
You're listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life about the mental health system in Ireland. In this six-part series, we ask why our mental health system is so dysfunctional, who is responsible for making change happen, and how we can collectively respond, join the dots, and make things better for all of us. I'm Paula McLaughlin.
And I'm Ciara O'Connor. And in this series, we'll be tackling some tough issues and sharing stories about mental health which may be difficult to hear. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. Or if you just need to talk, you can contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP.
I remember this story. Someone asked the question, Eddie, what's the most important person on the ship? On the ship, and people might say, oh, it's the captain, because the captain decides where the ship goes. Oh, it's the engineer, because it's the engineer who puts the coal in the ship and it progresses on from there. Without power, it can't go. But actually, it turns out that the architect is the most important person, because the architect makes the ship and the capacity of the ship and the ability of the ship to do certain things. So we've got to get to the architect of mental health services and design them in such a way that they're fit for purpose. And we're not talking to the architects, people that design and deliver services, enough. Putting more money into the same thing is not going to get the outcome we want. We need to get beyond that. This is 21st century Ireland. Our mental health services are actually structured around 19th century models.
That's Dr. Eddie Murphy. You'll remember him as a psychologist from our last episode. And in this week's episode, we're going to talk to some of those potential architects about the problems and possible solutions to our systems and models around mental health.
One of the things I enjoy about Christmas time is when you go up to the attic and you take down the Christmas lights and they're a complete impossible tangle. For some reason, I like teasing these apart and, you know, disconnecting all the knots that they've somehow found a way into when you carefully packed them away the previous January, and now it's time for Christmas again.
This is Martin Rogan, head of Mental Health Ireland, formerly one of the heads of mental health in the HSC. And it's a good thing that Martin likes big, tangled, messy problems, because the mental health system in Ireland is like the worst Christmas tree-like tangle you can imagine. When we first went into making this episode, we really thought, well, there'll probably be three or four big issues that need to be fixed. But this goes deeper. In this episode, we'll hear about the usual issues, waiting lists, resources, recruitment. But we'll also hear about deeper, more ingrained problems, culture, governance and funding. But just because the problems are big, it doesn't mean we can't do better. And it doesn't mean there aren't solutions. It just means the solutions are going to need to be radical. But before we get into the architecture of the system, let's do a little bit of archaeology.
We have to throw back a little bit in time here. I suppose the original mental health system, as we now call it, probably goes back to about 1815. There was a big investment in Ireland right through the 19th century, particularly between 1840 and 1860, in building asylums. And this was a response to a variety of different things happening in social change. We had a lot of migration associated with famine. We had a lot of vulnerable people whose healthy family members had left, and there was no obvious support system. And poor law in Ireland was poorly developed as well. Unfortunately, the way the state set up its asylum system, it created a model where local landed gentry would contribute half the cost and the exchequer would balance that half. And unfortunately, this created an economic driver for creating a huge asylum system, because you could essentially double your money in your local community. And we got to a point where we had 22 large hospitals right across the country, sometimes very large, daunting, quite Spartan, and it accepted people with a whole variety of needs, including learning disabilities, orphans, graduates from Magdalen laundries, people who'd been abandoned by families, vulnerable individuals, elderly folk, and occasionally people with mental illness. And this reached its peak in about 1950, when 22,000 Irish people lived in psychiatric hospitals. No other country came close to this. Even Stalinist Russia was a long way behind us when it came to institutionalising people with mental health needs. So this was an extraordinary legacy. There was a huge infrastructure. There was a lot of careers built on this. There was a lot of physical buildings. Whole towns became associated and became euphemisms for mental illness. If you were gone to Mullingar or if you were gone to Ballinasloe, this was a kind of a very finely veiled description of a person had hit a vulnerable moment in their lives. And one of the huge difficulties was there wasn't really a belief in recovery. So the expectation was when you went in, you really wouldn't return to your community. As newer and more effective treatments became available, people began to recover, began to be discharged back into the community, but the community wasn't ready. So when the HC came together, bear in mind HC was an assemblage of 11 health boards, which were all quite different and distinct. There were quite different tribes, but now they were somehow bundled together in this new organisation. And there's a great optimism about this because there was huge variety right across the country, extraordinary variation. And some parts of the country had wonderful services for older persons. Their neighbouring area might have been really particularly good for people with disabilities. Another part might have been, you know, excelling on children's-based services. There was no one centre of excellence for all this whole suite of services, and extraordinary inconsistencies and a huge disparity in the level of resource that was available. For example, if you were living in Carlow or Kilkenny, the level of resource and mental health spending per capita was four times that of your neighbouring county in Kildare. And I could never work out what was so special about Castledermot that made your mental health four times worse if you went south and made it four times better if you went north. But again, some of this was associated with the institutional legacy, where you had hospitals, you had budgets, you had staff, and County Kildare, County Longford, North Tipperary, County Meath never had a historic hospital. So, and at the same time, they were all showing huge population growth. So you had a very thin veneer of service and very little by way of service response. One of the challenges we had in the first instance, for example, a modern mental health service has five staff types. And these would be psychiatrists, psychologists, occupational therapists, social workers, and mental health nurses. And they are the five kind of primary colours if you're building a service. They're the components you need. When we did an audit, we discovered there were 42 species of staff employed by the mental health service. And it included at one stage 42 seamstresses and six butchers. Because the service had been a land-based service, grew its own crops, made its own clothes, and at-hold institutional staff group belonged in the asylum, in the large hospital, etc. But now the question was, how do we reassemble that staff group into the modern service as described in Vision for Change?
What year would you be talking?
I'm talking 2006.
What?
Absolutely. And in fairness to staff who signed up and took up positions at certain points, and sometimes people had very long careers, the mental health service has changed much more than any other aspect of the health service in Ireland. If you were to go to St. James's Hospital in Dublin, which is about a 600-bed hospital, and said, I'll be back here in 20 years' time and you'll have 60 beds, nobody would believe that. But over the course of my career, the mental health service bed number has done a pendular swing from having 12,000 beds to about 1,200 acute beds. So no other part of the health system, even though the mental health service come in for a lot of criticism, it's not for the want or the enthusiasm for change, it's simple resourcing.
So we've actually come a long way since the 70s, 80s or even early 2000s. We've now moved beyond the asylum model, and we were trying at that time to create something new. A community-based model. But the problem was, no one was really clear on what that model might look like.
But what was clear is that these asylums, many of which were pre-Victorian, and which minded people in custody for life, with little or no hope of recovery, that they were fine at one point back in the 17th and 18th century, but in fact were no longer appropriate in the 20th century and onwards. So I think everybody agreed they had to go.
This is John Saunders. He's the chairperson of the Mental Health Commission, a body which inspects all mental health services in Ireland and advises the government on changes needed in the system. He's also the CEO of Shine.
So the next stage, well, what are we going to do instead? Well, what happened was that various models were developed, like group homes or hostels. These would be small houses in the community where people would live in small numbers in a more friendly community-based environment. So you might have a house in the street, in the city, where four or five people lived together with support, as opposed to in an asylum 2 miles out of town. The other model was the idea that people could perhaps stay at home, but come to daycare or day hospitals for support as required. It was also realised that some people for some time would require some residential option. So the main replacement for the old residential model, the old asylum, were small units attached to general hospitals. And they provide the residential component for people who require, usually for critical reasons, to be in care for a short period of time. So the pattern of being in a hospital for life is gone.
The model we have now is based around two tiers of care. Primary care, which is usually your GP who makes an assessment to see if you need more specialist care in the form of the secondary mental health services. Some of these are in the community and some are inpatient. All of them are psychiatry led. Back to Dr. Eddie Murphy.
My view is that mental health is where cardiac services were in the 1970s. They're tokenistic, they're underfunded, and they're overwhelmed. We need to do something different. How we deliver mental health services, how we approach about mental health, needs to be thought about differently. We need to plan our services differently. We need to find more solutions, and we need to find them fast. Our funding is broken. We're way below the averages in terms of our spend on mental health. Currently, it's around 7%. We should be up around 12-13%. That's where most developed economies are under mental health services. And there's a lot of political game playing around mental health. If we're serious around mental health, then we need to be serious about how we deliver and design our services. And too often, in my experience, we don't talk to people who manage and design services. Mental health services is seen too often in a very narrow focus around severe and enduring mental health. So if severe and enduring mental health are those individuals who enter into mental health services with maybe schizophrenia or bipolar and require significant episodes of time within mental health services. And this is about 10%. Now, it's probably the most complex 10%. But we've 90% of other mental health that's totally ignored. How do we build emotional resilience in our primary schools? How do we ensure that people that transition from home into colleges are appropriately supported and have good mental health skills, good resilience skills, good stress management skills, good life skills, so that they don't get swamped when they move into these different transitions in their life? How do we support the 90% to stop them entering into mental health crisis? And how do we ensure that our services are accessible and timely so that they exit out of those services? Fundamentally, anyone that engages in a mental health service, the task for us is to ensure that the person is supported to get back to the best that they can be.
GPs across the world tend to be trained to recognise mental health issues and respond, but they need to have an array of responses.
This is Martin Rogan again of Mental Health Ireland.
Simply a prescription-based response is far too narrow and very limited. They need to have an array of responses which include social prescribing, green prescribing, connectivity, psychotherapies, individual CBT and other based models, some of which are now appearing on mobile phones, but increasingly, but people still prefer FaceTime psychotherapies where that's possible. And if the need is more sophisticated than that, you need ready access to specialist skilled mental health professionals. There are parts of Ireland today where if you're in distress with your GP, a service can wrap around you within a matter of hours and respond to you in your own home with your family if you want your family to be involved, or perhaps in a day hospital, or perhaps in an inpatient setting. So 90% of mental health needs in Ireland are at primary care. Only 10% of people are referred to specialist-based services, and that's increasingly in the community. And of people who use community services, only 10% are admitted to hospital. But there is a tendency, we see now, for example, about 10% of the Irish population are on antidepressants. And that may not always be the best solution. And I really prefer not to see people just using a single tool. It's very important that you have an array of options.
So when the GP isn't available, one of the only options for many people who are feeling in crisis or who are at risk is to get out of hours care at A&E. And it's also the main port of call in the evenings or at weekends.
The reason that this is the place to go is the only profession who can do a formal assessment of somebody in distress is deemed to be a psychiatrist. Our mental health model places psychiatry at the centre, so you're always going to be bounced back into a hospital or medical model. Your average person would dread spending more than 5 minutes in A&E, even if they're feeling really well. So it's pretty clear that A&E is not a good place to be when you're feeling distressed.
So we know in Ireland every year in A&E departments, there's 37 across the country, there are 12,000 presentations of people following self-harm. That's a huge number. We know that we lose about 500 of our citizens each year. It's reduced a little bit in recent times, but it tends to be of that order to complete self-harm or suicide. And, you know, this is the absolute, you know, worst outcome in any public health understanding. You know, for families, just the lost individual, it's just, you know, there's no way back from that. But 12,000 people present in A&E. We also know that beyond that number, there's about 60,000 people who self-harm and don't present at A&E. So there's a real issue there. We also know that if a person has a very significant, perhaps long-standing mental health issue, their risk of self-harm is 20 times that of their next-door neighbour, except in the 48 hours after discharge. And then it rises to 100 times. So oftentimes you're actually not doing the person a favour by admitting them to hospital. You sometimes worsen the risk of suicidality. Going in is difficult. Coming out is more difficult. So we need to make sure that we have a range of options that don't remove the person from their natural habitat, create solutions for them that work and are robust and are fully available, and don't involve sitting in an A&E department for 7 or 8 hours to, you know, have a really difficult engagement in a very busy space that will not really do justice to what's going on in terms of the complexity of your life.
So if people are suicidal, then they would be invited to go to accident emergency. They would be assessed by a liaison psychiatrist. They would have a faster access to psychiatric assessment. But a psychiatric assessment isn't an intervention per se. So how we've configured how we make these assessments by embedding it in one profession is erroneous. It operates off the erroneous assumption that only one profession can do these assessments, or only one profession can complete a comprehensive assessment, and then they'll distribute the work out to the team members. Because, I mean, I know from a psychologist, because I am a psychologist, you know, psychologists spend 8 years, we spend a lot of time, we engage a lot of assessment, and that's a core focus on our work. So, and it's not that we're any better in doing assessments either. The data shows that no individual can predict suicide outcome of suicidal ideation. But what we do know is also that if you make timely interventions, instead of having a single point of entry, you're going to have a better outcome. So we've designed a service that's embedded in a number of different vested systems, and we need to open that up to ensure that people get timely access. This is not about enhancing other professional groups. This is about timely access to individuals, vulnerable individuals, so that they can get to the best place they can be at. We do need radical overhaul. We need to see mental health not as a preserve of any dominant professional group.
I sat down with Lisa, who's been in and out of the mental health system for a number of years now. Lisa has had depressive episodes, suicide attempts, and has a history of self-harm and eating disorders. She is a total expert on the mental health system in Ireland. She's been in community care, day hospitals, she's been a private and a public inpatient, and here she talks about the problems with being sent to A&E.
If you just go there and you say I'm in crisis, you are not even on the bottom of the list of people to be seen. You're like on next week's list, because unless you've also got a physical injury, they'll just leave you there for God knows how long. So let's say you've gone to A&E and you get seen, you say I'm feeling suicidal, the triage nurse will triage you, she'll put you down, send you back out again. God knows how long later a psych liaison nurse will come by to talk to you. When that happens, what they do is they talk to you for a while, get your history, whatever. Then they say, okay, we're going to contact your local mental health clinic. And then you go home and wait to be contacted by your local mental health clinic. It's so archaic how it runs. Like, my GP has to send a letter in the post to get me referred to see a psychiatrist when I'm in a crisis. And I know already, I've said to some people, they'll say, well, why didn't you go to A&E? Because you can go to A&E. And I said, great, I'll go to A&E and I'll sit in A&E for 20 hours by myself in a waiting room, ignored, just sit there for 20 hours. So that's why going to A&E is not an option, because that's what happens when you go to A&E. Nobody helps you there either.
If somebody came down from a different planet and looked at how we've organised our health service, they'd say this is mad. They wouldn't go there because this, what we created is log jams all over the place where people can't access services and families are struggling and individuals are struggling. But what happens is we don't have the early intervention stuff going on, which means that for some people they can escalate into more crisis, into more severity. And when you have more crisis and severity, trying to enter the door of CAMHS and everybody else trying to enter the door of CAMHS, it gets stuffed up.
As Eddie describes, the waiting lists are a warning light for a major problem in the system, and it's a sign of massive system failure when things are this stuffed up. Lisa told me about a recent experience of waiting for help after she went to her GP and said she was feeling suicidal, and how she describes it, the difficulty in getting a referral, the complexity of accessing the right help, and that painful, painful wait. It illustrates the impact that our system is having on people at their most vulnerable.
So I went to my GP and I said, you know, look, I've been in the services before, I've been on medication before, I think I need help, I need some psychiatric help. My GP, who was lovely, didn't have a clue. So I remember I had to sit in her office explaining to her how she referred me to the HSE mental health services. She was Googling and I was explaining to her what to do, how she had to send a letter, where to refer me to. I can still remember so clearly, because it's always so surreal, because you're like, why am I telling you how to do your job? This is strange. And so she said, I'll send off this letter, that's the process. You go to your GP, your GP sends a referral off, and then you have to wait. And I knew she put on it, you know, urgent priority, but I'd have to wait. Unfortunately, things escalated and I attempted to take my own life. Did not succeed because one of my dogs woke up. And I remember the next day, because it's a weird thing when you try and clear yourself. It's not like necessarily that you're just in a ball on the floor. I got up the next day and went to work. I remember with a scarf around my neck to hide the marks. And I got into work and I just couldn't. I was like, I can't, I need to go home. I can't be here. And they said, well, why? And I said, I'm not feeling well. And they sent me to the corporate doctor who was across the road. She said, well, what's going on? And I said, well, I tried to hang myself last night. And she said, why are you here? Why are you sitting in my office? Like, so she rang my GP and said, you know, your patient is here in my office and this is what's happened. If I send her to you right now, will you see her right now? And told them what had happened. And thus began a 2-hour wait while they tried to get through to my local mental health clinic where my referral had been sent, because nobody would answer the phone. Nobody answered the faxes. There was no other, you know, there was no email or anything to contact them. It was a fax and a phone number. And they didn't want to let me leave their office with nothing. I refused to go to A&E because I didn't need to go to A&E, because I knew what would happen in A&E is they'd refer me to my local mental health clinic. So, and I think the first, they said to me they'd give me an appointment in 2 weeks. And I said, well, okay.
What good is that?
It's 2 weeks and...
That's a lifetime.
Oh yeah, a lifetime. My GP was trying then, do you know what I mean? When she was really like trying. She just didn't know what to do. She didn't have the knowledge of what she should be doing, and then the other side was impossible. I think they gave me an appointment for 2 days' time then. And so that's the best they could do. So I went home. My mum at this point knew, and she was concerned, very obviously very concerned. She knew I'd been self-harming again for a while, and she rang up Pieta House. So I was self-harming and suicidal, and I also suffered with an eating disorder, which was untreated. And when I went to Pieta House, they couldn't help me because I had a dual diagnosis. Maybe as a rational person, you can see, okay, they're not trained in that. But to me at that time, it was the worst possible thing that could have happened, because I'd now been rejected by my employee assistance program. My GP couldn't do anything. Pieta House couldn't help me. I was waiting to see my local health clinic. It was just the worst thing that could have happened. I just felt like everything was just being closed in my face.
Waiting lists, by definition, are lists of people who may require the service that they're waiting for, but may not.
Again, John Saunders of the Mental Health Commission.
There's no way of finding that out, unfortunately, until you go through the waiting list. But you're right, if there are the types of supports that some people might require at primary level, then they don't need to go to the waiting list. They get dealt with at the community level. I think the problem is to some extent structural, but it's also around models and how the model of service that you want to provide. I think Ireland has got it right in the sense we're saying primary care is the first stop. Primary care should involve not just medical, but psychological and social interventions. We haven't just got the structures there to do that yet. We don't have enough psychologists in place. We certainly don't have enough social interventions in place. I do know anecdotally from talking to people who use our services, Shine particularly, that many good practices now, GP practices, they may not have the resources there, but they have ways of referring people to resources. So there's a huge reliance on the private counselling services, for example, or sometimes in alternative medicines. So you get people referred to acupuncture or to other types of interventions. So many GPs, I suppose, they've already figured out that we can't wait for a state system to do this. We would actually create a referral system that allows me as a GP to assess, okay, you need this, which I can provide, but you also need something else that this person can provide.
Putting someone in crisis on a waiting list is not good enough. That person should get immediate care. And it doesn't have to be medical care. We also need social and psychological interventions to be available for people in crisis. And while it's probably a case of needs must, referring someone for acupuncture or for private and sometimes unregulated counselling isn't a substitute for a formal system that isn't going to be cost prohibitive and is going to have fully trained and qualified teams of supports and structures in place. We spoke to Dr. John Hillary, president of the Irish College of Psychiatrists, who resigned from his role in the HSE last year because of ongoing problems in the system and a seeming unwillingness to address them.
I left my public job early. I haven't had an exit interview. No one asked me any of that. My exit interview was a presentation I gave to different groups, a group of carers and a group of lawyers and doctors. That was my exit interview, but it was me telling people things. No one took me aside and said, look, you're leaving before your time. You're president of the College of Psychiatrists. This is kind of embarrassing for us. The president of the College of Psychiatrists should leave us. I mean, if you were a private company and the president of the national group in that area was resigning, you'd want to know why, wouldn't you?
John describes an all-too-common situation for psychiatrists. Because the issue with psychiatrists being responsible for all mental health in Ireland, with all other supports being seen as merely ancillary care, affects their profession in a fundamental way.
First of all, I was in a service that had two consultant posts and the other one was empty, so I was being expected to carry that load as well. So that's dangerous for patients, dangerous for me, and the longer it goes on, the more dangerous it gets. And then I was dealing with a subspecialty where I was dealing with people with intellectual disability, and it's not so much about the treatment, it's often about the environment, and I couldn't affect the environment. Now, I've been trying to do that by writing memos for 20 years and other things, but it finally got down to myself asking myself, what effect is this having on my health as I reach 60, and is there more I could do with my energy? I don't see my duty as being to prescribe medication. I'm trained to prescribe medication, but if my training is any good, it should also show me when medication is needed, when it's not. And one of the reasons that I left work, I stated this quite publicly, is I was prescribing medication for people to make up for service deficits. So I was trying to make people safe by putting them on medication that might help their anxiety and their agitation, when I knew really the main thing was environmental change or other interventions that weren't available. I think I'm not alone in that. And we don't have enough psychologists. A lot of my colleagues in psychiatry are trained in different therapies, such as cognitive behaviour therapy, DBT, dialectical behaviour therapy for personality disorder, different things like that, but they don't have any time to do them because they have a clinic with 50 people waiting to be seen. And in our system, the consultant psychiatrist in a geographical area is responsible for anyone in that area with a mental illness. And that's takes a lot of your time. We're trained to work closely with our colleagues in psychology, social work, and occupational therapy. But often people are left not having access to those people, or else those people have long waiting lists too. And so you do what you can at the time to help people. And what I always have asked myself is, if I don't think that medication is the first input here, but I've no other access to the other inputs for a few months, do I leave the person distressed in the meantime when I know the medication might help in the meantime? Or do I put them on medication, which may give someone a chance to say, oh, well, Dr. Hillary has treated the person, they don't need to see someone else. So I have to do two things. I have to say, well, look, I think you need this type of intervention. I'm referring you for that, but you're very distressed at the moment. So I think this medication would help. In the meantime, I want you to come back and see me in a few weeks, and we'll see how you're doing on the waiting list for the other and then I'll send another letter saying this person needs to be seen. That's part of our system. It's not right, but it's the way we try and get the system to work.
Lisa told me about what kind of experience she has sitting with her psychiatrist, which she sees every week for 5 minutes. And she also described what her local day hospital was like.
About five minutes with the reg once a week, yeah.
And what was that visit like? What would
do you want to kill yourself still? Yes. Have you self-harmed? Yes. Are you eating? No. Is the television talking to you? Still no. I'm not schizophrenic, so no. They have the same list of questions they would ask me every time, and the answers would always be the same. Sometimes we would try and increase medication. They did, when I came out of John of God's, they sent me to day hospital. They have those in a lot of the mental health community centres. So the one that I went to, which was for Dublin North, the day hospital, I would go there Monday to Friday, because when you start out, you get your leg go for 5 days. And I'd go in the morning. I'd be there by 9:30, which would be tea and coffee, half an hour of just sitting with tea and coffee. Then we would talk about the newspaper and do the word wheel from the newspaper on a board all together. Once or twice a week, a woman came in to do art, but it was just like Bob Ross art. It was, you know, let's paint, copy a waterfall or a dandelion or something, which I'm not artistic that way, so I had no interest in that. Once a month, somebody came in from Grow, but they just came in to tell us about Grow. We didn't have an actual meeting. They just would tell us if we wanted to join, this could happen. So I think I did that 3 times. And it was the same thing every time. I just thought I was never going to get better. Ever. Never, ever going to get better. I was never not going to be this broken, you know, person. This was just going to keep going on and on and on.
The media love these arguments and love this fact that the doctors are evil and money-grabbing. But psychiatrists mostly work in the public sector. They're paid a certain salary. And if they sit and drink tea all day, they get paid the same as the person sees 200 people. And actually, I think the person who sits and drinks tea all day is probably not doing as much harm as the person who sees 200 people a week. But we didn't go into psychiatry to do either, shall I say. We went into psychiatry to have more time with people, to tease out the different issues, and actually to be a good psychiatrist. And a friend of mine who's a GP says it very nicely. He says he thinks that psychiatry is the hardest part of medicine to practice well and the easiest part to practice badly. By that he means you get away with practicing it badly. Mm-hmm. But what we see then when people are practicing it badly is people aren't recovering and getting back into society. Mm-hmm. But it is very complex, as the discussions we've had would suggest, because you're talking about brain chemistry, you're talking about sociological issues, you're talking about family issues, you're talking about genetic issues, as opposed to a simple default in something in the body that needs to be fixed. Yeah, exactly. It's much more complex than that.
I became suicidal again. I attempted suicide. I have lost count of the amount of times that I attempted suicide that year, and ended up in Beaumont, which is my local hospital. I ended up in Beaumont Hospital. I don't know if every hospital, they have basically a list of people who attend their A&E for self-harm reasons, whether it's self-harm or suicide. And after a certain number of times, you don't get seen by the psychiatric team anymore because you're a repeat offender. So you're just a waste of resources because you're a self-harmer. You know, my husband would bring me to needed stitches or whatever it was. And I would be there, left there for hours upon hours upon hours. I've never been treated more like a piece of dirt than in A&E with self-harm injuries or after attempting suicide. You know, I woke to have nurses talking about me at the end of the bed. You know, when they were doing handover, it was, oh, she's just another suicider. I've been told, oh, you're too pretty to be self-harming. Do not think about your family, don't think about other people. I would be triaged and bandaged and then left for like a day. Like, just wrap it up. As soon as they heard it was self-inflicted, that was it. I was bottom of the list, no one cared. And like I said, after a while they stop even letting you see the psych liaison nurse because you're a waste of time, because you're just going to end up back there. I think it's a culture. Like, I overdosed in my house once and a friend was there in the house and she called an ambulance and she had to help carry me out to the ambulance because one of the paramedics just stood over me and said, does she do this a lot? And apparently wouldn't touch me. I was unconscious, so I don't know. They took one look at my arms and the scars and they said, oh, she's one of those. That attitude has happened to me for as long as I have been, unfortunately, going to A&E or going to clinics with, you know, self-harm. It's a stigma that we're time wasters or we want attention, that there's no help for us. I don't know if it's because they know that the services are so bad, so there literally most of the time is no help, or if they are just overworked and understaffed and they have run out of empathy. I don't know what it is, but it's been something that I've experienced since I first went to A&E to get stitches in my arm, which is when I was 18. I've encountered somebody who was kind or polite a handful of times, and I've been a lot. I don't like going to A&E. I don't want to go to A&E. I don't want to waste people's time. Unfortunately, the people in my life keep trying to keep me alive, so they bring me a lot. I had my own like Steri-Strip set and stitch set at home, so I wouldn't have to go to A&E, and I would have like discussions bartering with my husband whether or not I needed to go into A&E because I wouldn't want to go because it was so horrible for me to be there and be so judged and treated so badly that I was like, no, it's fine, we can deal with this at home. It doesn't need actual stitches. I can do this myself with paper stitches.
What Lisa is describing is a really big problem that we hear from people again and again. The stigma that exists within the mental health system itself. A lack of training. A lack of understanding. And it hammers home the point that nurses and doctors who are dealing with urgent physical needs, like road traffic collisions and strokes and hemorrhages, you can understand that they may not see someone with an invisible need as being urgent. You can see how people get deprioritised. And when you look behind the curtain into the mental health services, you really see that even beyond the stigma, there are huge challenges in the system which go right through from the very top at governance level to how the system measures what success looks like, right down to basic administrative failures. John gave us some pretty shocking examples of these kinds of problems and how they play out from his experience working within the HSE's systems, starting right from the very beginning when they're looking for resources at a local level.
So it's also difficult, I think, for the mindset of certain accountants to grasp. We're renting a room in the middle of Tala or the middle of West Clare for some guy to sit in it and talk to people. it's costing this much. We could have an outpatient in the hospital for that much and be seeing 20 people. And if you hear people talk about health service delivery, they say, we opened 10 new outpatients across the country this year. They don't say we got 500 people back to work this year. We got 500 fathers back to their families. We got 300 kids back to school. We got so-and-so back to the GAA club who was afraid to go out of the house. You never hear that. But we have more and more clinics. Now, if you can't go to the GAA club because you have agoraphobia, a clinic isn't going to be very helpful because you won't be able to go to the clinic as well. But it would be really helpful if you employed a nurse or a therapist of some type who can go to John Hillary's house. John used to be really involved in the GAA. Something happened. He actually can't go out of the house. The first thing was he stopped going to the GAA club. The next thing that happened was he stopped going to mass. And the next thing was that he started missing work. And then he lost his job because he couldn't go to work. And we did give him an appointment for the clinic, but he never turned up for that. And that's really irresponsible of him because we've a long waiting list. But hang on a sec, John didn't come to the clinic because he can't go to the GAA club, because he can't go to mass, because he can't go to work. So we need Mary, to use a stereotype, to go to John's house a few mornings a week and start bringing him back into society. But it doesn't show up very well on a single accountant's sheet back in the department. It's difficult to put a KPI on it, I think. And we had a situation a few years ago where we got quite concerned because the HSE brought in what they call never events. These are events that are never to happen. And one of them was suicide. And we all strive, obviously, that we don't have anyone who kills themselves. But to say it be a never event, especially if you're responsible for all of society, not just for people who are deeply depressed, is impossible. So I think people get frightened about what KPIs are going to be made up in psychiatry. And do they actually capture what you need? I mean, if you were going to say no deaths, that's not a great KPI, really, because what we're talking about is quality of life. Yes, yeah. People living a life in society and committed to it and getting some satisfaction out of it. It doesn't have to be happiness or joy, but satisfaction about inclusion. And having death as one of the events you recur is probably not really a good reflection of that. So we need to work harder on finding KPIs that suit Irish society. And there are models from other countries, but we need to mould them for Irish society. But once again, is there the will to do that? Or are we back to saying, well, you saw 100 patients this week? And we hear Michael O'Leary talking about how he'd run the health services, and that's all well and good about getting the customers through. But if I, as a psychiatrist, have five people with serious agoraphobia who can't leave their house, seeing 300 people this week might be good for the person doing the balance sheet, but the five people who want to leave their house need more than the 5 minutes I could give them on the phone or whatever. I can't even give them that if I'm meant to see so many people. So the KPIs have to be relevant to people's lives. What happens me often is I'll get a phone call and it'll be, John, this is Paul here. I have a patient that I don't know where to send them. Who would you recommend? I have GP friends ring me up all the time. They shouldn't have to ring me up. Yeah. Do you know a friendly psychiatrist to see this person quickly? We've no communication, you know that. We've no electronic record. Sorry, now you've set me off. So say you go and see someone. It's in a GP surgery where I'm doing a locum. I'll have your details there from the GP. But if you go into Casualty tonight in Talla and you attend me in where I used to be up in Jobstown, if you went into Talla tonight, the doctor, and Andrea's called to see you, she has no access to my notes at all. They're all up in Jobstown. I could have been seeing you for 10 years and you've never been in hospital. That could happen. She has no access to that. She's totally reliant on what you tell her at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're really distressed. Even though it's 5 minute drive away, but we don't have any IT system. And where that really came home to me, my mother died a few years ago. And anyway, I was off work for a while. But when I went back to work, this guy turned up at the clinic and he was a lovely young man. I was a bit uneasy, but it all went well. And I saw him on his way and I wrote to his GP. And then the secretary said, we have another chart on that guy. And I said, oh. And I took it out. And this was a guy who threatened to get a bottle and do me in the week after my mother died. So I didn't remember him because of that. But the system had no way of telling me either. And I was seeing him on my own in an office with a secretary down the hall and no one else around to help me, which I wouldn't have done if I'd seen the other file.
John says we need to investigate the system properly and thoroughly in order to find out where there are gaps and inadequacies.
The first thing would be to find out why individual journeys are going wrong. We don't have any information across the health services. Why are people not getting tests when they're meant to get them? Why aren't they turning up for clinics? Why are the people like I'm talking about not getting respite when they're 18, even though everyone knows they need it? We need information. And I think any company would then say, we need to see why our customers, sorry to make it very crude, aren't getting the service they need. All we do at the moment is record that they're waiting for the service or that they're delayed in the service, but we're not asking why. And how can we do anything till we know why? So we're wasting all this time throwing money at something without knowing where we should throw the money. If you went to a bank with the type of business plan that the HSE seem to have, you'd be told to go away and come back when you have something better. These are good people. Like, these are not bad people, the people in the HSE doing these things. And there also is an issue I've seen over the years too in this organisation where people are put in a certain position, but they aren't given the power. Or they're given responsibility without power. Or they're told they have the power and then they find they haven't got it because someone has bypassed them. So there's a lack of governance. Going back to our conversation about why I left, I was existing in a very heavily regulated environment, and I've given a lot of my professional life to regulation because I was a member of the Medical Council for many years. I was president of the Medical Council. I was president of the International Association of Medical Regulatory Authorities. So I believe in regulation, but it should be a regulation that encourages change for the better instead of just penalising people. Mm. And what I've seen happen with HICWA is that people have become afraid to the extent that instead of trying to change things or saying to HICWA, this can't be done unless we get money, to which HICWA will say, that's not our business, which is nice of them to be able to say that, but we're meant to be all in this together to make things better for patients. What I've sat at meetings where I've been shouted at because a report about the risks to people or the risk to a patient was something that the administrator didn't have the resources, obviously, to implement and was being questioned by HICWA for not implementing it. So instead of saying to HICWA, well, I don't have those resources and I could do it, attacked me, shouted at me and waved the report at me and said it had to be changed. If you're going to handle regulation by saying, well, we're going to change our opinion, we're going to get the doctors to say it's actually not as bad as they said it was initially. Mm-hmm. That's not good for anyone.
No, that's
what's happening.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm talking about my own personal experience and another reason why I left. I felt compromised in that way. That I was going to be asked to put people at risk by administrators who were under pressure from HICWA, instead of it all being something we work in together to make things better. But I've seen so many staff beat down, demoralised, crying because they're being shouted at for not delivering on something they can't deliver on because one person can't do all these things. Yeah. And instead of the leaders going back to HICWA and saying, well, look, you're saying this, we all agree with that, but unless the government provides the money, we can't do it. Mm-hmm. They're shouting at the people beneath them, bullying them. What people are asking people like me to do is to pretend things aren't as bad as they are, or that really people aren't as sick as that, or they don't need that, or nobody's dangerous. It's your fault for talking about someone, as I was accused once of being inhumane by saying that someone was a risk to other people unless they were supervised. That was my professional opinion, and I was shouted at.
Time and again, we hear that the recruitment of psychiatrists is one of the big issues in the mental health system, causing all the delays and wait lists. Services are overwhelmed because there are these unfillable posts. First of all, this is an issue which would be easily resolved if other professions were allowed help triage waiting lists. We asked John, what's going on here? Why is there this huge shortage of psychiatrists?
Well, we're getting the trainees in now. But unfortunately, we're losing them then at the other end to the private sector, or people are going away. And there's a lot of disincentives in the system too at the moment. So for instance, sounds crazy, but if you have a fully trained specialist in one of our services, they may have a temporary person working with them who isn't a fully trained specialist but is paid more because they're paid through an agency to fill an empty space. That's a disincentive probably for the person who's full-time, fully trained, went to all that and isn't getting paid as much, but not so much as a disincentive as it is to the person who says, well, I've done my basic exams now. I can look at 4 to 5 more years training to become a specialist, or I can contact an agency and I can get a job paid at such a rate straight away because they're wanted all over the country. It's a really strange disincentive that the state has introduced here.
The system is slow and it is not set up to help people who are asking for help. It's set up to make things harder for people who are already in the darkest, loneliest, emptiest place that anybody could be in, and it makes it harder, and it shouldn't do that. I mean, if it is hard, if it is full of paperwork or, you know, lists and phone calls and faxes, the patient, the service user, as they say now, they shouldn't be aware of those things. know what I mean? They shouldn't be aware there's a struggle or there's big long waiting lists or that it's inconvenient or it shouldn't be that way, because they've asked for help and that's what our mental health services are supposed to provide, but they don't. They don't give you help. They give you more problems. They make you feel like a problem. Like you're just another person they have to add to their list of patients that's already miles long. It's supposed to make you feel like you can go there and ask for help. And I've never felt so lonely or so lost or so hopeless than most of the time when I've gone and asked for help. Because you get turned away or told to come back later where they're too busy. You should never be too busy if someone is asking for help. Nobody wants to be in crisis. Nobody wants to be in crisis. It needs to be treated as serious as it is, and it's not in this country. It's not seen by a lot of people as that important. Do you know, that's like, we need more services. We need more training. But most of all, you need the person who's looking for help to not have to worry that they're going to get turned away if you ask for help. Because what happens, if that happens once, you're not going to ask for help the second time. What good is a plan for next year to somebody whose child or sister or uncle or aunt or friend is dead because there wasn't enough resources, because the waiting list was too long? You are not going to turn around to somebody who needs chemotherapy and say, you're going to have to wait 6 months. We're a bit busy. Can you just put your cancer on hold? What's going to happen without treatment? They're going to get sicker.
So you're probably thinking right now that this all sounds pretty bleak. Over-reliance on psychiatric teams, waiting lists, over-prescribing, unclear pathways, a reliance on A&E for out-of-hours, a slow, sluggish, old-fashioned system whose staff are overworked and overstretched and are doing their very best in a terrible situation. The question I was left with was, how do we even approach fixing this? And as Dr. Eddie Murphy said earlier, we need a radical overhaul, and radical really is the operative word. Looking at what seems to be this big, massive, complex Christmas tree-like tangle, there are a couple of truths emerging.
If you beefed up the primary care system to provide a range of different interventions, you'd actually release the pressure on the secondary mental health care services, which don't need to deal with people who perhaps only have a temporary issue that can be resolved. You have to become urgent to get the attention, and by definition, that's the worst place to be. It's much better to deal with someone who's in not so urgent situation and try and resolve whatever is going on with them, say in the privacy of their own home or in a clinic or in primary care, instead of waiting to the point where they're having suicidal ideation or self-harming to the point where they're endangering their lives. That is very much downstream. And while we have to respond to those people, we do need to put a huge amount of energy in preventing people getting to that place. And I suppose it's part of human nature that we build fire brigade systems, but we now have, after many years of thought, lots of fire prevention activity to stop the fire starting. Similarly with ambulances and accidents. We need an ambulance service for road traffic accidents, but we've a huge amount of work going on around preventing the road traffic accident, engineering and policing and so on and so forth. In health, we have moved in physical health down the road of prevention. What is it we can do as individuals or as groups or as families or as societies or as governments to actually stop me or you becoming so unwell that you require secondary mental health care services?
What we need is 24/7/365 services that are, once a person is assessed in the physical environment, then they move to appropriate environments in the community where they can be supported by trained mental health staff. We don't need emotional health care or mental health care in physical care environments.
like hospitals?
Like hospitals, like acts of emergency. If you go to different countries, there would be counsellors attached to the different schools, or school psychologists attached to each of the different schools, and they're able to support children in the transitions that they make and the struggles that they engage in their life. What we really know is that people who express mental health in their adult life, and that's coming from their adolescent life, mental health is a human rights issue. And until we start realising that, like, that's another sort of, I'm really getting fired up again now, because we're tolerating individuals in society, children, adolescents, young adults, adults, older adults, with high levels of distress. High levels of distress. Some can't function. And we're tolerating that as a society. If you have a broken leg in the morning, you can go in and get surgery on your leg. If you have something broken in the context of your mental health, you can't access that service.
Our history, our legacy, is utterly entwined in our current situation. We might not have the asylum buildings anymore, but we still have a lot of the dehumanising, alienating and isolating tendencies in the culture and systems of the HSC. First off, we need to remove the reliance on psychiatry. We need to build a primary care system that works and a community-based model that is functional, fully staffed and resourced, offering counselling and social supports in a timely way when people need them. Systems need to seamlessly talk to one another and provide warm handovers when someone in crisis is being passed along. We need to bind staff at every level. We need to help them to help others and support them and train them so they don't end up reaching burnout. And we need to focus a lot more energy on early intervention and prevention rather than way downstream when people are already far into a crisis and showing up in A&E in utter distress. Many of the problems are organisational and philosophical. It's not just a matter of simple resourcing. Empathy, kindness and understanding won't come from a funding increase. And finally, rather than adding awkward extensions, rebuilding bits here and there and cobbling together a modern system from 19th century models, we really do need government to employ architects who can design a system that actually works and that puts people with all their messiness and their fallibility at the centre. I'll end this episode by quoting surgeon Atul Gawande, who says, "Culture has tremendous inertia. That's why it's culture. It works because it lasts. Culture strangles innovation in the crib. But better is possible. It does not take genius. It takes diligence. It takes moral clarity. It takes ingenuity. And above all, it takes a willingness to try." In the next episode, we're going to look at our government's leadership around mental health, our policies, the politics, and the plans for change, many of which never make it past a glossy report, a launch, a promise made, and a promise broken. We'll ask how we can hold our political representatives accountable for all they promise to do and also on what they do not deliver. Next week on Where There's a Will.
Thanks for listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review us on iTunes or just tell a friend about us. Also, we want to hear from you. Have you had experiences with the system, good or bad, that you'd like to share? Or have you ideas on how we can make things better, easier and faster for people to get help? Send us a short voice recording to editor@alustforlife.com or record a WhatsApp voice note and text it to...
And just as a reminder, if you have been affected by any of the issues raised by this podcast, there is help available. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. If you just need to talk, you can also contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP. Check out alustforlife.com for contact information for all of the support available.
Where There's a Will, the podcast series from A Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.